The United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit is now open and in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, everyone. The first argued case this morning is number 20-1902, Doe against the United States. Mr. Morris.
Good morning. Thank you so much, Your Honors. Christopher Morris on behalf of Appellant John Doe. May it please the court. There are two salient questions, I think, that the panel needs to grapple with and wrestle with in this case. The first one being, did the deactivation of the appellant John Doe in April of 2008 put him on notice such that the claims that are at issue today accrued under the definition of accrual in FAR 33.201? Second question being, assuming that it does the continuing claims doctrine continue to toll the statute such that this claim and complaint should continue and survive?
Well, counsel, you didn't argue the continuing claims issue in the claims court, and therefore it didn't decide it, and so that's not properly before us, is it?
Well, Your Honor, that's a good question. You know, I don't think that we used the talismanic phrase, continuing claims, but we did argue and argue substantially the continuing claims doctrine in that these claims continue to accrue. What he was told at the time that he signed the deal was that it would be not only the direct consequences of the direct forfeitures that he was involved with, but also the tendrils of all of his information that he was giving. And if you look at our reply brief, pages 12 to 17, we argued extensively, pages 7 to 14, we argued extensively the different, probably 27 different entries where we argued this factual basis, that these claims continue to accrue down the line and that the tendrils of this information continue to potentially lead to captures and forfeitures.
Counsel,
so we may not have used it.
This is I see where in your gray brief you've identified some quotes for us, as you just mentioned, and you definitely repeatedly assert the fact that there could be new leads or compensation all the way down the line, but I don't see where in anything in this gray brief, in any of the quotes you've identified, I don't see where there's a legal theory expressed for why the statute of limitations should be treated differently and not as a one-time event. Instead, should be, you know, even something, even if you didn't use the words continuing claim doctrine, I don't even see where you evoked the concept of it other than just alleging a fact about the contract. Could you address that, please?
Sure. So what we address was that as these claims continue to accrue potentially, and discovery would hopefully reveal that the statute would start again. I mean, we don't know when those claims.
Counsel, this is Judge Stoll again. I simply don't see that in the quotes you've provided in your gray brief or elsewhere in the record. So if you have an example, for example, I'd love to see it. I want to make sure that I give your argument full consideration. Thank you.
Sure. So if you look at Appendix 77 through 78, Mr. Doe in this case was told that the asset forfeiture cases take a long time, and just because they were able to seize the money doesn't mean that they were able to then disperse the money, and that whoever the person against whom that money was seized could file all sorts of motions that hold up the seizure and disbursement of funds for years and years.
But a continuing
claim
argument implies that it keeps accruing, with subsequent events accrue a new period, a new actionable claim. And that, as Judge Stoll suggests, that's not here.
Well, I think if you look at Appendix 78, Mr. Doe was told that the tendrils of his information could be wide-reaching and could result in arrests and forfeitures and seizures years and years down the road, which would then be subject again to the forfeiture due process proceedings that are available to persons against whom money and assets are seized. So, I mean, even though we didn't say continuing claims, we talk about how these are going to lead to new forfeitures and new seizures. And that's why he continued to believe that as these accrued, that he would be given the chance to his commissions or his deal would be in effect.
Is there some place in the record, counsel, this is Judge Stoll again, is there some place in the record where you tie this alleged fact to the statute of limitations?
Well, I think that's kind of the crux of the entire arguments that we were making down below, was that each of these claims as they came up would, again, be subject to the forfeiture proceedings and the due process proceedings and would take time and restart the statute of limitations clock. That was, even though we didn't say continuing claims, that was the crux of the entire argument, was that, hey, these things are going to be coming up, there's going to be new arrests, new investigations, your information is going to have tendrils that are going to then restart. And I think that's what we're asking for, is just a chance in discovery to look at those new cases, new forfeitures, and new investigations and determine whether or not they do fit within the six-year rule.
Counsel, am I correct that the hearing pages on which you referred us to, pages A77 and A78, relate to a hearing that also involved a question of whether a contract existed? I mean, statute of limitations was certainly not the only issue being discussed in that hearing, right?
That's true. That's true, yes. That involved whether or not a contract had been formed and whether or not the contract would be barred by the statute.
Is there anything in the complaint about the continuing claims doctrine?
Well, I think in the complaint we talk about that this was just a... Let me see. Hold on. Yes, I think if you look at page 8 of our reply brief, we cite, the agreement also included a provision where should plaintiff's information lead ICE to more information, plaintiff would be entitled to a percentage of all seizures pursuant to those new leads all the way down the line. And that's Appendix 20 through 21.
Well, to get to the substance of the argument accepting for the purpose of what I want to ask you, that the idea of continuing claims, which certainly has a basis in law, even so, would your client, is he claiming entitlement to anything that may have been earned earlier than 6 years before this complaint was filed?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you for the question. And that goes back to the accrual question. And that question, I think, supersedes the continuing claims doctrine, because you'd have to be put on notice for the continuing claims doctrine to kick in. And you have to look at what happened in 2008. And in April of 2008, if you look directly at the notice that was given to him, and that's at Appendix 44, it's entitled Deactivation Notice. It was entitled Deactivation Notice. So he was deactivated as a CI, but it doesn't say repudiation of your ongoing deal, repudiation of your past deal, and we're not going to honor the service that you've already rendered. It just says you are hereby deactivated. And if you look, he was told, as far as the one seizure that he was paid a down payment on, that particular arrestee was turned into a CI, and so that's why he didn't pursue, because he figured that the forfeiture of that particular person may not be taken into effect, and may not, you know, he may get his stuff back if he's turned into a CI, at least the cash part. And so that's what he was told when he inquired, was that arrestee has been turned into a CI. So simply deactivating him as a CI wouldn't put him on notice that his deal was somehow being revoked or repudiated.
Well, there is this gap of, nonetheless, we have 6 years to work with, and whether is the idea that the earlier collections were the substantial ones, so that unless they're included somehow, there isn't enough substance to proceed. It does, you know, the purposes of statutes of limitations are pragmatic and realistic, the preservation of information and evidence. And so if, in fact, accepting that there is a period for which the statute has not run as to what's included in the potential claim for that period?
Thank you for the question, Your Honor. I think under the FAR, in order for the statute to begin to run at all, there has to have been the claims or facts that were known or should have been known to the claimant such that he was put on notice. So I don't see that six-year statute as a statute of repose, meaning anything previous to 6 years is dead regardless of notice. I think it's under the FAR 33.20, the statute doesn't begin to run at all until there's facts known or should have been known to the claimant. So I think that we can go back to the 2008 claim.
Counsel,
was that a beep?
Counsel, that was a beep, but I have a question. This is Judge Lurie.
Yes, sir.
The government denies that there was a contract at all, except on confidentiality. And I know you stated you couldn't keep a copy, but apparently there isn't a copy on record, and the government says there wasn't a contract.
Well, I think in footnote 5 of the government's brief, they state that is not an issue ripe on appeal, but I would like to address that issue, which is under the cases cited in our brief, it's pretty clear that a contract with the government can be both written and oral. And in this case, he did perform, and he was paid, and he did sign an agreement. So together with those documents, together with what was told to him and what his testimony will be, I think will be sufficient for there to be a finding of a contract. And we just like the opportunity to present that evidence and to discover that evidence. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
This is Judge Stoll. I just wanted to ask one other question, which is that the court found that Mr. Doe's threat to take legal action in April of 2008 shows that he knew that, you know, he had a claim at that point. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think threatening to sue legal action for what was due, and then you have to also look at what he was told, which was that particular arrestee was turned into a CI. And so that is what told, and they told him it would take years and years down the road for these things to come to fruition. So I think that he was upset when he was terminated, said, I should sue for what you've already taken from me. And the guy said, whoa, wait a minute. That guy's turned into a CI already. So there's really who knows what, you know, how long that's going to take. And that was at Appendix 51 through 52.
Okay.
No.
All right. Well, no, we'll save your rebuttal time, but let's hear what the government has to say.
Great. Thank you so much.
Mr. Bixley?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I hear you.
Okay. Thank you. May it please the court. In this case, Mr. Doe waited 11 years to file a lawsuit for an alleged breach of contract, an alleged breach that he was aware had occurred in April of 2008, when the government did not pay him for services performed as a confidential informant. His complaint is clearly time-barred, as the trial court appropriately held.
But you say alleged breach, but were there no communications from Mr. Doe after that initial one for which the breach is purportedly alleged?
Well, yes, we say alleged breach because what the trial court did was giving Mr. Doe the benefit of the doubt, accepting the facts alleged in his complaint as true, that his breach of contract claim accrued no later than April of 2008. That's what the trial court found.
Well, but he also says that there were promises that there would be future payments, and that those future payments can't have been breached until there was the appropriate time for an accrual of those payments. Isn't that accurate?
Yes. What Mr. Doe alleges, he alleges the existence of a contract which has a term that in exchange for information and services, he would receive up to 25% of all cash seized and $1,000 per kilogram of drug seized. And he also says, as a condition of this alleged agreement, that information, it's conditional. For example, I'm looking at he alleges that should his information lead ICE to new leads or information, he would be entitled to compensation all the way down the line. So he alleges a condition of this agreement, but he does not allege facts that any of his actions led to new leads, new information, new seizures. He only alleges it as a condition, one of the terms of the agreement, but he does not allege facts that it actually occurred.
Well, he wants discovery in order to find out what happened to his ensuing disclosures.
Yes.
And we're saying you can't get into court in order to do that because you waited too long. And we're trying to figure out when that period of too long started.
Yes, Your Honor. So the basis of the government's motion and the decision of Senior Judge Smith in the trial court is that all events which gave, which occurred, which fixed the liability of the government to pay him and entitled him to payment, to institute an action, occurred in 2008. As he alleges, he was basically became a confidential informant. Early in 2008, he participated in four undercover operations, three of which resulted in the seizure of cash. He alleges the amount seized that he participated in, discrete amounts. He alleges that in these undercover activities, he seized kilograms of cocaine, $1,000 per kilogram, that's 25%. In his complaint, he alleges, in effect, on February 5th, 2008, he received a single down payment of $10,000, and that's all he received. He further alleges, and this is a key paragraph in his complaint, paragraph 34, he threatened to sue for the amount he was owed.
I'm not sure I understand the point that you're trying to make. He asserts that there were promises to pay that were made after that date that you're referring to, and that those promises continued, as well as other obligations accrued. So would you focus on what happened after he was paid the $10,000 and was told, so he says, that more was promised?
Yes, Your Honor. So after he was paid the $10,000, which occurred on February 5th, 2008, shortly thereafter, apparently he threatened to sue, and then he was deactivated as a confidential informant in April of 2008. And this is relevant because his services as a confidential informant ended at that point. So he provided no further services after April of 2008. But in answer to the court's question, his allegation that he would be entitled to additional compensation in his term all the way down the line, that is simply a conditional term of the alleged agreement.
Well, now, the issue is not whether or not he's, as a matter of law or fact, found to be entitled. The issue is whether the statute of limitations has run so that he can't get into court to explore these substantive issues.
Yes. Mr. Doe actually alleges in his complaint that his claim is accrued. I direct the court's attention, for example, paragraph 51 of the complaint. He alleges that he performed his obligations pursuant to the agreement and provided ICE with information that led to multiple arrests and seizures. Therefore, the conditions required for defendant ICE's performance had occurred. He states similar allegations.
Now, the question is, when was the contract breached?
The contract was breached and he knew it was breached when he fully performed his part of the bargain and the government refused to pay him.
No, it's when the government, the contract was breached when payment was refused. Isn't that right?
That's correct. Yes.
But he was told, according to the record, that this is a continuing operation of seeing how much you're entitled to, not that you'll never be paid.
There's nothing in the complaint that stipulates, for example, the standard for claim accrual in a breach of contract context is set forth in the Oceanic Steamship case. And in Oceanic Steamship, what the Court of Claims found in that case was that by the terms of that contract, there was to be a final accounting. That's when payment would be made. There's no such statement in this alleged agreement. So, in other words, yes, there's a conditional statement that should additional amounts be collected, he would be entitled to compensation. But his complaint does not allege that actually happened. It's just not in the complaint. The only events which occurred which entitled him to payment are these three undercover operations that resulted in actual seizures. Those are the only events which actually occurred.
Well, still getting back to the problem, if it was sooner than 6 years after the date that you allege, he would be then it would be easy, and he would, we assume, be entitled to discovery and could find out the facts that we don't know in terms of what was promised and what was entitled. So for you to tell us certain facts that haven't been established doesn't really help.
Well, Your Honor, in other words, our position here is that based upon the discrete allegations, the discrete events, essentially he alleges three breaches. These three undercover operations which actually resulted in seizures and money due and owing to him, which he knew about, and he knew he had the right to sue. And all this happened in 2008. Those claims are time-barred. As to whether there is a separate, distinct breach based upon continuing seizures down the line, that would be a discrete event. That's a hypothetical. He has not alleged that facts have occurred which would entitle him to payment. But
well,
so that
he doesn't
would be
know
a
those
event.
Facts.
And if,
he doesn't pardon? Know those facts. How can he allege them? He just suspects that there's more to this than he's been allowed to know.
Yes, Your Honor. In other words, what I'm saying is for what he alleges and as I said, these three events, these three undercover operations, and I think this is what the trial court's decision goes to. As to these matters, he's clearly time-barred. And briefly, I'd like to just address the continuing claims issue.
Counsel, this is Judge Stoll. Before you move on, could I ask you a question? Yes. I just want to clarify your position. As yes. I understand it, you've said that the alleged agreement, as described in the complaint, accepting all the allegations in the complaint is true, does not defer payment. And because the alleged agreement does not defer payment, the statute of limitations accrued when payment would have been due, which would have been after the collection of the drugs and monies that you previously identified and that are identified in the complaint, which would have been by April of 2008. Do I understand that correctly?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. I think I was addressing the continuing claim. I think that is correct. That is waived, as we have argued. We note that Mr. Doe did not appear pro se in this case, even at the pleading stage. He was represented by counsel, and at no time in the trial court proceedings did Mr. Doe, through counsel, argue a continuing claim. And in fact, in the argument at the trial court before Senior Judge Smith, what they argued was that the statute of limitations should be told. That was one of the defenses they raised. And clearly that's not appropriate under the John R. Sand and Gravel case. Going back to the issue of the conditional term of this alleged agreement, payments all the way down the line, and the issue potentially of discovery, I think we're in hypothetical territory that the government's position, I think some of the questions that came up, was that, in fact, the actual agreement that was signed did not reflect a promise to pay Mr. Doe. We cited that agreement on pages 3 and 4 of our brief. Now, this issue was not decided by the trial court. It is not really before the court here today. But certainly, if there was a claim for additional monies based upon that alleged contract, again, it's hypothetical, but we would revisit this as a new issue and perhaps look at that, whether in fact there is a contract. So we don't necessarily concede that point, I would add.
It's very curious to hear you argue this, and at the same time, he was paid $10,000, and you're saying that was just a gift out of the kindness of the government's heart, that there was no obligation?
No, what I'm saying is our motion was based on, it's a bit of an odd case, because I think in confidential informant cases, typically, the allegations are based on an implied fact contract, that there's no written.
Please continue Sorry. The thought if
yes.
it's not finished.
So his allegation was that, in fact, there was an actual written agreement, an express contract. So we called that into question and produced what he actually signed.
Well, the government, as I saw it, never denied that there was no written agreement. You're just saying, you're too late, go away, you're not entitled to discover what's in our records.
No, in our motion before the trial court, we said there was a written agreement, we produced it. In other words, that was signed by him and ICE, but it did not reflect what he alleged.
Counsel, this is Judge Stoll. Do I remember correctly that, in fact, the Court of Federal Claims considered your argument that there had not been a contract proven of the type that was alleged by Mr. Doe?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
I thought that there was a trial below, or at least a hearing below, before the Court of Claims, and one of the issues was whether, in fact, the agreement alleged by Mr. Doe existed or not, whether in fact Mr. Doe had proved the existence of the alleged written contract. Am I correct in understanding that, or do I misunderstand the record?
No, what was that issue was he alleged the existence of a written express agreement, which reflects the terms as he alleged in his complaint. How the trial court treated, but the government produced the actual document that was signed by Mr. Doe and ICE, and Mr. Doe argued that, in fact, there was a different or an additional agreement. So the trial court noted all of this and said that the parties disagree as to the actual terms, and then the court addressed the matter and accepting the allegations as true as the existence of a contract, as alleged by Mr. Doe, found that it was time barred. So that's how the court treats it, and that's what's before the court here today.
Okay. Any more questions for Mr. Pixley?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Morris, you have your rebuttal time.
Yes. Thank you so much. I'd like to just kind of work my way backwards on the arguments that were made by Mr. Pixley. The first one is this notion that the only thing we pled was the written agreement that was provided. He was given a written agreement that laid out the rules of confidential informant, but in our complaint at Appendix 17, we also alleged that he was provided a written agreement that provided for payment, the payment parameters, and that that agreement was not given to him for safety reasons. And so that's one of the things that we're looking to discover. So the express contract was not only the CI rules, but the written agreement that was not provided that he signed, which laid out the parameters of payments. And then if you look at Appendix 14 through 17, going back, working our way up, we allege very clearly that he was told that as each of these new investigations arise, that he would be paid for the information, the secondary and third tertiary investigatory information and seizures that he was responsible for. And,
counsel, this is a very good story, but the problem is that the burden of proof is on your client, isn't it?
It totally is, and that's why we're... Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And there is no documentation of this contract payment.
Well, right, but again,
off record,
we're at the pleading stage, and so he pled that he was given a written contract, and that the written contract laid out the parameters of payments. And then I think it's important to know that he was questioned, okay, what happened? What's going on? And he was told, hey, you got to wait. This guy's been turned into a CI.
This is Judge Stoll. In your complaint, do you explain or allege that the written agreement that Mr. Doe was not given a copy of either did or did not defer payment? What did it say about when payment was due?
Well, I think he doesn't know exactly what the written part of it was, but he was told that payments would have to wait till the forfeitures are done.
After he signed the agreement, right? There was a written
agreement. As part of the agreement. As part of the agreement, it was like, here's the you're going to get, you know, X amount for kilo, X amount for this, 25% of cash, but you got to wait.
Where does it say in your complaint that as part of the alleged written agreement, it said he had to wait?
Let's see. I think I would refer the court to Appendix 17, and where it reads, should someone be arrested on information, and this is paragraph 26. When plaintiff inquired about his commission, he was told that the member had been turned into a CI.
I understand, but that was after the alleged written agreement, as discussed in paragraph 23 of your complaint on the same page, correct?
Correct. So I think we look at Appendix 17, and it reads, should someone be arrested based on information provided by plaintiff, and that person gives up their supplier or other pertinent information that leads to more seizures, plaintiff would have been entitled to compensation and commission from those seizures all the way down the line.
Correct, but it doesn't say anything about deferral of any payments or anything like that, right? I understand the fact it's alleged in your complaint.
Right. It's just that it's going to take a lot of time. So
where does it say that in paragraph 23 in describing the agreement? You're just saying that you have to infer that there will be additional payments, and you have to infer that those additional payments, all of the payments, will be held up until all action has been taken, right? Is that what you're saying?
Well, not only that those, for a particular discrete event, those payments would be held up, but as more investigations yielded more forfeitures and more seizures, that those then would have to also take time, and the due process forfeiture proceedings would have to take time, and the appeals and all that stuff.
I don't see that in paragraph 23. I don't see that. Did you at any point attempt to amend your complaint?
I don't think so. I don't think so. We didn't amend the complaint yet. We weren't given leave to amend.
Did you ask for leave to amend?
Yes.
What did you want to amend? What did you want to amend in the complaint?
Well, I certainly would have amended to allege more facts about the actual parameters of the agreement as far as payment procedures and payment timelines.
Where is that motion? Do you have a docket number for the case below where you made that motion?
I don't have that at my fingertips, Your Honor. I apologize. Let me look through it quickly.
Counsel, your basic problem, one final point question, is if your client thought he was not being treated properly according to what was agreed to, he didn't wait a year or 2 years, 5 years. He waited 11 years before suing.
No, that is a problem. I mean, I can't run from the fact that it's 11 years old. I have to embrace that. But, I mean, from the perspective of my client, he had been put into hiding because of what happened. I mean, he was burned as a CI. His life was threatened. He went into hiding. He actually moved out of the country and was afraid. And I think, you know, if you look at those facts and say, okay, is there a way for this guy's claim to be revived, you should also take into account the context of the delay, which was this guy's in hiding. He's afraid. You know, he now has a wife and kids, and he didn't want to raise this issue, and he only raised it when he called me and said, hey, is there any chance? I said, well, you know, it's 11 years, but yeah, I think there's a chance because, you know, you're the one who was told that this thing's going to take forever, and you haven't raised it, and that's why it took so long. But yes, it's 11 years, and I have to embrace that and recognize that it's a long time.
This takes us into the equitable tolling aspect, but certainly it seems that this focuses on the problem, which seems to have concerned Judge Smith as well. You go back 6 years from the date that this complaint was filed, and everything seemed to be very quiet, whatever breaches had occurred, accepting that there may well have been breaches occurred before the date of filing minus 6 years. And how does the court overcome that?
Well, I think you have to determine whether or not he was actually put on notice in April 2000.
Whatever might have been an event within that six-year period to have kept the claim alive.
I'm not sure I understand the court's inquiry. I think the claim when he inquired about his commissions and he inquired about what was happening, he was told, hey, this guy's been turned into a CI. It's going to take a long time. And so that's why he didn't pursue any claims when he was deactivated. And again, the deactivation didn't say repudiation or we're refusing to pay for anything that you've done or any of the proceeds of the tendrils of the information you've given us. It was just you are hereby deactivated. Had he known that they were going to then disclaim any of the compensation that was due to him there or due to him in the future, I think he definitely would have pursued it or thought about it. But you have to remember, his identity had been burnt. He was scared and he was in hiding. So that becomes part of the problem. I realize there's no equitable tolling, but I think the context, the overall context of somebody who goes into service for the government and puts themselves at risk should also be taken into account when deciding whether or not these claims should be revived and allow us just to do discovery. We don't know if there's something that's within that, assuming the six-year period applies from the date of the filing of the complaint, but I think that he's entitled to at least know. And we don't know, but I think he's entitled to at least discover. And then we can fight about whether or not those claims should survive on a summary judgment motion. But at this stage in the proceeding, with what's gone on, I think my client is at least entitled to know.
Yes, okay. So any more questions for Mr. Morris?
No.
No.
All right. Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under submission.
The court will pause.